Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber Podcast. My name is Tony Groves and we are back with a good news story. And a good news story. It's great to have something. And people are getting mad at me now going, oh, you always pin your colours to your flag. Absolutely, I do. There is bad news. Martin's also here. Martin, how are you?
Thanks, Tony. Yeah.
But the good news is actually, last night many will have seen the results were very quickly turned around in the Colombian presidential election. And despite what would it say, it was the last time we had a conversation with our contributor today, the feeling of not exactly optimistic, but we thought maybe there was hope. And we are joined by Nicolas de Leal, a Colombian journalist. And Nicolas, you had kind of said to me as well that, you know, no matter what the outcome was, it was a historic to get that far, to get there. But he went and bloody won it. Petro is going to be president. And not only is he going to be president, it's going to be the first female black vice president as well. So it is a big, momentous event. How are you feeling?
Well, I'm very happy, very relieved as well, to be honest, because the fear of it not happening was very large, but extremely happy, very hopeful, and also will now hopeful to see what's going to happen, no? Because this is just sort of the first step, but it just shows up such a big change in the country that has happened in the last few years, and this result really shows it. So really looking forward to the next 4 years and to see what happens.
Can I ask just on the so we talk about Colombia in the large extent of swathe of time. It's never had a leftist president. We had that conversation a couple of weeks ago. Now we're facing, we've seen protests over years. We've seen unrest. I know we were talking about, you know, some of the events that have taken place, the crackdown on freedom of expression and people worried about inflation. I have also seen some scaremongering already in Western media about Petro as a populist, and you know, everybody leads with the same line, former guerrilla fighter. Can you just give people, if they didn't listen to the previous conversation we had, can you just give people an idea of who this man is? Because for my money, he seems like a moderate center left kind of candidate.
Yeah, I mean, obviously it's just all relative, no? So in Colombia, 50 years of civil war made the left intrinsically related to the guerrilla movement. But so I think really since the peace treaty signed with the FARC in 2016, this discourse, this position sort of was able to enter the mainstream. And this, I would say this is the result of that, even though there was a big backlash, you know, in the 2018 elections, which were basically about that peace deal. But now, sort of the paradigm has shifted, but if you put it in a international context, and if you really look into his proposals and his plans, it's not a radical left at all. He proposes radical shifts, but that's in a very conservative country that had a lot of failings. So he does propose to change radically the health system, the pension system. He proposes a big land reform. So he does propose, you know,
the land reform one is actually going to be very difficult, because as I understand it, Colombia is a large country with a large population, but much of the land use is controlled by, you know, a handful of people. So that is going to be very, that will be looked upon as almost Marxism.
Yeah, well, the thing is, I mean, bottom line, that was what the 50-year civil war was about in Colombia, was land to big extent. But he doesn't really have to do too much, in the sense that the land reform is part of the peace treaty. So he can just say he is going to fulfill what was negotiated and what was signed and what was agreed upon, that the previous government has, you know, very clearly sort of decided not to implement, despite in international community saying that they are fulfilling the peace treaty, but everyone in Colombia knows that they're not. So it's just a matter of him and his government sort of fulfilling that. So it it shouldn't be that difficult in the sense that the lines are already drawn and he doesn't have to propose something from scratch, which probably would be harder. But if he has that backing of that robust peace treaty that right now a majority of the country is backing, he should be able to do it. That being said, he has, you know, time and time again assured that it's not a land reform that depends on taking land off these big landowners. Rather, it's taking land away from people who appropriated land illegally during the conflict. So that's one part. And the other part, which is his proposal mainly, is to make productive the land that is idle in Colombia, which is a very, very big part of the country. There's also a big part of cow farming, which is very unproductive use of land. So he also wants to shift that and shift away from fossil fuels and just to be more of an agricultural economy, which is Colombia's big sort of asset, it's a big country and very fertile.
It's a very quick change. I mean, 2016 was the peace agreement, and now we're in 2022, and he's actually in government. I mean, that's a massive, quick change. How did it come about, Nicholas?
Well, I think the big part is the collapse of the right and the more extreme right, which had been in government in the early 2000s. And basically put in the previous government of Iván Duque. But they've collapsed in the sense that without the FARC, their whole ideology and discourse is empty. You know, they are opposed to a guerrilla movement. And if that doesn't exist, then their heavy hand and military sort of ideology doesn't have a place in the political discourse anymore. And these four years of government of Iván Duque have really sort of brought that idea home that's obsolete completely. And not only in terms internally, this is a wider thing as well, I think, in the world and in the region. As it is, it fluctuates, but it has to be said that this follows a certain trend. No, Chile in December, obviously Mexico, it has similarities, it has differences, because I wouldn't say López Obrador is the sort of a traditional leftist president. He's got many more sort of hues, and it could come, you know, full circle if Lula wins in Brazil.
There's Brazil, there's Mexico, Bolivia, Chile, and Colombia. I mean, like it's funny, Martin. Our Latin friends in Portugal will be watching this with interest.
Absolutely. And I'm just thinking it's very lucky that the Americans are so busy elsewhere. It really is lucky that the Americans are so busy elsewhere.
Yeah. I think, well, in that sense, Colombia, it's going to be interesting the role they play, because obviously Colombia has been pretty much the biggest ally or the most stable ally of the US in the region. It's been the only one that's never had a government that's been hostile. And I actually think Petro wants to maintain that. And I think or at least this is what the indication seems to be, that the agenda is going to go mainly around environmental terms.
It's a red-green government. His party is essentially an amalgamation of 20 ecological and socialist type parties. That's what it is. It's indigenous, socialist, and environmentalist. And his agenda seems to be climate, tackling that, and as you said, developing the agricultural system and simple things like education, health, healthcare, and pensions. I mean, you know, this is not a radical in any stretch, but maybe he's a radical in the context of Colombia's history. Can I ask you, Nicholas, how was it? Do you feel it was received? Because it wasn't you know, it was close. It was, what is it, 50.047 of the vote to 47% to the king of TikTok. Self-proclaimed king of TikTok, I must say, Mr. Hernandez. But yeah, how was it received, do you feel?
Well, from Petro supporters, it was really complete exaltation, you know, parties on the street. I mean, it's moving, to be honest, that this has happened in this country. Apart from the history of guerrillas, you know, in the 90s, when Petro's own guerrilla, the movement he was a part of, demobilized in 1990 and 1991, they helped write a new constitution, and they had a presidential candidate, and he was murdered. And then the leftist political party was exterminated, you know. Between 2,000 and 4,000 people were killed by the government and right-wing paramilitaries. So there's this sense of justice being done, finally, you know, that after all these years of you know, absolute persecution, that a guy like him and his ideas are there.
How safe is his position, Nicholas? I mean, is there any chance that those forces could oust him in some way?
It's hard for me to say. I think if he's got this far, he's okay. That being said, I don't know how they still have a lot of power. You know, that they have drug money, they have armies.
They have militias, yeah.
Yeah. And they can make things very difficult in the regions. You know, they could, you know, ramp up violence and make it very difficult. He has to get the army on board. The army is very, very right wing after years of counterinsurgency being the ideology. I think there's very, very strong hostility toward him within the armed forces. So he needs to appease that and really get them in line, because he's going to need them, because violence is a very big problem in Colombia. And it's important to have, it's like he needs to fight.
Some of the simple things he wants to do, for example, we spoke about the Cerrejón mine and that's already due to be closed over the next sort of 8 to 10 years. He probably wants to bring that forward slightly, trying to even do that. There are militias there, and they're not called militias, but there are people, you know, who control those things. And so that stuff, you know, conflict is probably inevitable in some of this, Nicholas. And I don't want to, you know, to try and water that down. This is, there are people who have disappeared, and you know, we know what that means. You know, we know that what that means in an Irish context as well, folks. We know we have our own history with people being disappeared. But can I ask, on a global initiative, I saw, you know, tentative, you know, welcoming of the results by heads of state across the US and people in the EU. Colombia has still got you mentioned cattle farming and that, like, this is part of the sort of, you know, the free trade agreements that Colombia is tied into. Many of these are going to have to change in line with climate action and actually taking those steps. That's where I anticipate the biggest problems personally. How do you feel the economy will do if he starts to try and renegotiate or walk away from some of those things where Colombia is looked upon as to be extracted from, you know, because it has to export all of these goods to feed the European market and the US market?
I don't think that's a priority, in the sense that he knows he can't scare off these investors at the end of the day. So I don't think that's a priority, but he's going to renegotiate them more in a internal sense, because these trade agreements have crippled the local production, because it's cheaper to get you know, rice from Vietnam than produce our own rice. It's cheaper to get meat from elsewhere than it is to get our own meat. So in that sense, that's where he's been talking more. In terms of of trade agreements. So what I mean is mainly trade agreements with maybe Asian partners. Those might be renegotiated, but I don't think with Europe or the US it'll be I don't think he'll do it, because he needs to keep that support.
Yeah, I suppose it's the first springs of hope after a very long time of no hope, Nicholas. Do you think that it'll settle down, calm down, and it'll be just business as usual without any great commotion?
Well, that's certainly what he wants to happen, no? He needs the dollar to stay stable. He needs, you know, these few weeks before his possession will be very important. You know, who is he going to name as Minister of Economy is going to be very important, you know, and the line of his whole cabinet is going to be very important, just to see what he's going to do. Because as we mentioned last week with Tony as well, he's brought in he's cast a very wide net of supporters. So, and that includes, you know, center right, you know, traditional liberals. He is definitely going to be more moderate than, you know, the populist ex-guerrilla tagline suggests. He is not going to be, you know, he's not going to be Cuba, which is the fear mongering that you get in Colombia.
He seems to be a consensus builder.
I think he's learned to do that. He's had a very long political career, and he's learned
He didn't become the mayor of Bogota by running around with Che Guevara t-shirts and shouting stuff about that. He's a very long career. Someone was criticizing me yesterday for pointing out that I thought the Washington Post headline was trash, calling him guerrilla fighter. And you're like, going, that was 40 years ago, folks. Like, you know, no one caveats Nelson Mandela's things with, you know, former guerrilla fighter. But here we are. So it's just, yeah. It's a bit of optimism, Nicholas. That's what I put it. It's a bit of optimism. It's nice to understand that these things can happen. It's critical. It's critical that he, as you said, Martin, as a consensus builder, that people start to feel better economically and societally. They can see those changes. That's what happened in Portugal. We keep going back to it. First time they got in, they three times now elected, and the first time with an overall majority. And that's where the potential is for this, Nicholas. Look, I won't delay you much longer, but I will ask you one last question. In terms of this idea of this broad church for Colombia, it's 51 million people. There's a lot of people living below the poverty line. What would you like to see change? If what would be the things that he'd be able to turn around and say that's what he has to change? If he can do that, what is the big win he could have in his term?
That's a tough question, because there's a lot to change. Personally, it's not economic, but this is my really personal opinion. No, mm-hmm. It's the assassination of social leaders. For me is the big point, you know. His vice president, or our vice president now, Francia Márquez, I think she represents this part of the country that has been absolutely persecuted. So we were talking about leftist politicians being persecuted in the 90s, but this still happens with social leaders and environmentalists. So for me to see the government take that seriously is a very big change. And I hope that happens, because, you know, it's been hundreds in the last 4 years, you know, it's said lightly, but in any other country, it would be outrageous. But yeah, you know, in Colombia, you know, whatever, you know, I think the average is one every 2 days gets killed. You know, it's just absolutely outrageous. So that for me is like the most important thing. But in terms of economy, well, just very simply to get people out of poverty, to get the land producing again, and sort of get people hopeful as well. And as you said, I think the idea is this change takes a lot more than 4 years. So he just has to set some bases changed the sort of political climate as well, to see and have a sort of clear future, because it's going to take a lot longer than 4 years. So it's important that in 4 years' time, you know, someone who can keep his projects alive can come in, and not someone who's just going to burn down all those bridges.
And we've seen that from Portugal, Tony, where they started to measure the success by how the poorest were doing, not how the wealthiest were doing. And that, even that little change, got them back in two more elections after. So, you know, a change of focus does work, and hopefully that change of focus does work very well in Colombia as well. Nicholas, thanks very much for coming on and explaining this morning. I presume you're delighted. I presume you're very happy. Great. And I would ask the audience to stick with us. We have a little bit more to do on this. Nicholas, thanks for taking time to come and talk to us today.
Well, thanks so much for having me. Anytime.
It's a pleasure. Thanks so much. We're going to leave that there for you folks now. If you remember, please check out the full version of the podcast where we talk about the seismic shift in what could possibly happen in the large, how do we put this, industrial landlord class in Germany, and the SDP's vote on that. There's also a ton of additional content out over the last number of days, including Rory breaking down the CSO figures and what they say, the threshold report, and what it tells us about the level of evictions that is actually arguably the highest since the famine on this island. We also covered the Trackerman mortgage scandal, and I actually, I went a little bit two-footed in there. Daniel Murray from the Sunday Business Post joined us to discuss the dual energy crisis and climate action. And Rory had Michael McCarthy on, a quantity surveyor, to talk about modular homes and how the private sector can deliver in ways that maybe, you know, us on the left need to be a little bit more cognizant of, and at least, if not, at least hear them out. Thanks for listening. Thanks for the support. Please do consider joining us. It's the only way we keep these shows on the road. It's patreon.com/tortoiseshack. We've no ads. We've no sponsors. We'll rely on your kindness to pay it forward. Really appreciate it. And talk to you probably early next week. Take care. Bye-bye.
Tony and Martin, Martin and Tony, speaking to interesting people only. It's the Echo Chamber Podcast. Subscribe now on Patreon.